Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Mexico City for a reaction to a report by Human Rights Watch that over 20,000 Mexicans have disappeared, many at the hands of the military, during the last 6 years, in addition to the 70,000 who have died in the drug wars. Joining us to discuss the grim legacy of President Calderon is Joan Grillo, who covers the drug wars in Mexico for Time, CNN, and the PBS NewsHour, and is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Then, with 15 Republican senators writing to the president today asking him to withdraw the Hagel nomination, we will speak with former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb about his article at Foreign Policy, Hagel's Revenge, How Obama's New Pentagon Chief Can Get Back at His Republican Enemies. We will discuss the all but certain confirmation of the new Secretary of Defense and how, if he chooses to, Secretary Hagel could move bases and defense contracts from South Carolina and Texas to punish Senators Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz for their unwarranted and disgraceful attacks on his integrity and character. Then finally, we will examine why the global markets went down today, falling after some members of the Fed expressed concerns in just-released minutes of the board's January meeting about continuing to buy $85 billion of bonds each month. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss the consequences of the impending sequester cuts on top of money already taken out of a weak economy by the fiscal cliff deal that are certain to slow growth and economic recovery. And joining us now from Mexico City is Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for the international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, the Sunday Telegraph, and Reuters. He has covered the drug war in Mexico and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And what's the reaction in Mexico now from the release of the new report by Human Rights Watch that indicates that over 20,000 people have disappeared in Mexico during the 6 years of the outgoing president Calderon? The same period, of course, an estimated 70,000 people have been killed. But in addition to that 70,000 killed, 20,000 plus are missing.
Well, it's interesting timing for the report because it's come out, obviously, releasing more shocking numbers about the devastation that's happened during the drug war the last 6 years. But it's come out now as a new president has taken power since December. So it really talks about things that happened under the previous administration. Now, what it highlights particularly is 149 specific cases they looked at of disappearances where they say it is likely that the state forces were involved, either soldiers or police were involved in a disappearance. That's cases when you have somebody, for example, who was arrested by soldiers, taken away, and then last seen in the hands of soldiers, and then never seen again, and the soldiers were also, you know, kind of denied anything to do with it. Now, people have, you know, human rights workers here have been documenting this case for some time, but it's you know, it's powerful to have an international NGO with the name of Human Rights Watch come out with those kind of figures, and I think puts, you know, more pressure on this government to help resolve some of those cases, find some of those disappeared, bring criminal charges possibly against members of the military or police involved in those disappearances.
Well, my understanding is that the U.S., I don't know whether they were concerned about the new president being with the PRI party, the notorious party that was ruling Mexico for longer than the Communist Party of the Soviet Union ruled the Soviet Union. And there was I may have even spoken to you about this, the disquiet about the PRI coming back since they had obviously had such a cozy relationship with the drug cartels. And of course, this is the new PRI. My understanding is that the U.S. did weigh in and veto somebody that was being nominated to be the head of the Mexican military. Is that correct?
That was a story which was exposed by the New York Times based on some sources they had inside U.S. agencies. But the Mexican and U.S. government have denied that happened. So, you know, we have to try and make our own minds up if that happened or not. But the official line was, we're not concerned about from that point of view, that was the official line that the U.S. agencies always said, you know, the Pri's come back to power, we're happy to work with them. Privately, when you talk to some drug enforcement agents, they say, well, yeah, you know, maybe the Pri will be more tempted to make deals with cartels and so forth. But I think, as we know, there's a lot of very mixed feelings inside the U.S. administration about what's best for Mexico. I don't think many people in the U.S. like the level of violence that Mexico has suffered in the last 6 years. And this has been under a Pan administration. So they do think, well, perhaps something else does need to be done. But, you know, in terms of the Pri coming back with this, I mean, I think these disappearances, I mean, this is stuff which has happened under the Pan government, under the Pan president. So I think when you talk about these abuses committed by the military, forced disappearances committed by the military, this is very much on the Pan rather than on the Pri.
Perhaps you implied earlier, Johan Grillo, that it may not be a coincidence that this report's coming out now that there's a new president, Peña Nieto, and this report, of course, is critical of the prior regime of Calderón. But Human Rights Watch, of course, is an independent organization.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to comment too much on their timing. I understand, looking at the report, that they began investigating a year ago. So it was a long investigation. They wanted to document various cases, so it takes time. I don't know if they were thinking in terms of the change of administration, if that affected their choice of when they brought this out. The Human Rights Watch has had previous reports that were done during the administration of Felipe Calderón condemning military abuses. So they have done things. They're just saying, you know, then really it has a different implication right now, because if it was coming out right under Calderón, it would be a direct responsibility of that government. It would be showing abuse committed under that government, whereas this, you know, is a new administration, so they can say, well, okay, this looks very bad, but, you know, we're a new government in power, and things aren't going to be that way anymore.
So my understanding is that what the officials are more or less saying, you know, unofficially, shall we say, is that, well, maybe 20 to 25,000 people have been disappeared, but most of them are real bad guys. But that's not necessarily the case, is it? What Human Rights Watch has found is that a lot of these victims are innocent victims, like a group of men, eight young men who disappeared on a hunting trip in Zacatecas. They were apparently captured by Los Zetas, who are an extremely dangerous group of former policemen and security people who are totally psychotic. There was another group of young men as well, who apparently one of whom got into an argument in a bar, and the bar owner had friends in the police, so the police arrested him and then turned them over, either killed them or turned them over to a bunch of drug thugs that they were working with to have them killed. So I guess there's nothing new about the relationship between organized crime and corrupt police in Mexico.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very important point that you make, and it's always very hard to decipher this horrific circle of violence from outside of Mexico and what's going on. But yeah, it's a very important point that in the early days of this drug war, Felipe Calderón was insisting that, you know, the vast majority of people who were dying or disappeared and so forth were gangsters, were drug cartel members. And there was the old kind of wisdom, you know, on Mexico streets, that if you weren't involved in this, you didn't have to worry too much. You know, if you weren't trafficking drugs or a policeman or something, you didn't have to worry too much. But as you say, many victims have been innocent people who have been caught up for a whole variety of reasons, from simply going to a bar and getting an argument with somebody, to being a witness, just to being in the street in the wrong time, in the wrong place. And that's something which has been emphasized a lot by people like the poet Javier Cecilia, whose own son was an innocent victim who was killed, and who's led a movement called the Movement of Victims for Justice with Peace and Dignity. And he is searching and often brings forward the stories of victims and bring that into public consciousness.
Again, I'm speaking with Joan Grillo, who is in Mexico City. He's covered Latin America since 2001 for the international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, the Sunday Telegraph, and Reuters. He's covered the drug war in Mexico and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Now, in addition to the 20,000-plus people who've disappeared, according to this new report by Human Rights Watch in Mexico, that's in addition to the 70,000 who've been killed in the 6 years of the previous President Calderon, there is also a rash of kidnapping going on, isn't it, associated with the drug cartels. They've diversified, have they not, into other criminal activities?
That is correct, and that's been another real problem for Mexican society. When you have these armed groups of gunmen who make their money trafficking drugs to the United States, they're in a very powerful position to make even more money extorting the community and kidnapping people. And there's been a real rise in kidnappings in Mexico over the last 5 years. And very, very sad cases, particularly in areas where cartels are very strong, places in the northeast of Mexico, like Tamaulipas over the border from Texas, in places like Veracruz, in places like Zacatecas, in places like Acapulco, which have seen a lot of violence recently. So again, another real problem for society, and our reason is no longer a question of just saying, these are bad guys, the drug traffickers, they're sending drugs to Americans, and if we're not involved and we don't have to worry about it. These people are a real problem for innocent people in this country, Mexico as well.
Well, of course, the guns, which are, military-style weapons that these cartels have in Mexico, most of them, I think, come from the United States. They're bought at gun stores just across the border, and the ATF, because of the NRA here in the United States, has been totally hobbled from recording these gun sales and interdicting them. So
that's a good point. The guns here, many assault rifles, and that's the main weapon of choice of drug cartels, are the assault rifles, the AR-15s and the AK-47s, the Kalashnikovs, which are sold in U.S. stores. Now, these were prohibited under the assault rifle ban back between 1994 and 2004. If you look, actually, the cartel-related violence in Mexico first began to shoot up in 2004, so the very same year that the assault rifle ban was lifted in the United States was when cartel violence increased here. And you can see a clear relationship there. They're buying, it's a lot easier to buy AK-47s and AR-15s, bring them down here, and that set off a lot of the chain of violence. They do also get guns from other places. They also get some of the RPG-7s. They have the rocket-propelled grenades, and they get some of those from Central American military stashes, and they get fragmentation grenades and so forth. But the assault rifles are a big problem, and many politicians in Mexico and people in Mexico are in favor of a new assault rifle ban in the United States. They're very hopeful that this discussion that's happening in the U.S. Congress could lead to some action there, which would ease the situation here.
Well, it's pretty amazing here, working here in the United States, Joan Grillo, as a reporter, trying to figure out how it could be that the NRA, whose mantra is that they protect the legal rights of honest citizens to own guns, when in fact their record is pretty clear that they protect the rights of criminals and psychotic criminal thugs in Mexico to own machine guns. I mean, it's pretty surreal. The police chief in Nuevo Laredo, right on the border there with Texas, has disappeared. It's amazing anybody took that job in the first place. I mean, his predecessors have been murdered and disappeared.
Yes, and again, a problem going back for some years. I was in Nuevo Laredo back in 2005 and interviewed the guy who was about to become the police chief back in 2005. He was the head of the Chamber of Commerce in the city. and they've been in his office. 2 weeks later, he was appointed police chief, and when he first took the job, they said to him in a press conference, are you scared? Are you not scared? He said, I'm not scared. The people who are scared are the corrupt ones. And he was shot dead 7 hours after making that statement. 7 hours after signing and taking the oath of office, then he was shot dead. So that very sad. And then back in 2005 and continue to this day, that a very difficult job to be police chief in these areas, and a real threat to the basic rule of law, the basic operating of a state. There's a lot of discussion about, you know, what this violence in Mexico means, and some would say it was simply a problem of criminals or of gangs. You know, what I argue is a lot more than that. You know, this is a form of violence which really threatens the basic functions of government in this country.
Well, when you have this, apparently, the gangs and the police who work with the gangs operate on this idea of the choice is between plomo y plata, lead or silver. Silver's a bribe, lead's a bullet. That's the choice that you know, people who are about to be corrupted are faced with. And it's little wonder that so many police are corrupt, if that's the choice. I mean, in other words, look at the current chief of police of Nuevo Laredo. Given the history of the people in that, his predecessors, now he's disappeared. You know, you can understand why these low-paid cops are corrupt, surely.
Yeah, that's a major problem, and I think you have to look at the more fundamental problem of the $30 billion or so of drug money that comes every year from the United States into Mexico, selling of cocaine, marijuana, crystal meth, and heroin, and how you can stop that money coming. If you want to look at any long-term solution to this, there's got to be a way of reducing substantially those funds. I think it was very exciting to see what happened in Seattle, in Washington State, and in Colorado on November the 6th when voters chose to legalize marijuana there, and had that setting off perhaps a snowball effect. We'll see what happens in California with that, you know, and other states that could be the next ones to legalize marijuana. And if there's a big change in the whole policy of drug prohibition, this might be part of the solution in the long term to the violence in Mexico.
Well, as it stands, the American drug consumer is funding this mayhem in Mexico. And if you could find honest police and recruit them and have trained professional police and pay them a decent wage, you wouldn't have this problem. But is this new president, does he have the resources? In other words, here we are wasting billions and billions every year on this failed war on drugs. Why not spend some of that money on creating professional police forces in Mexico so that you don't end up with these criminal gangs like Los Zetas and all of these other cops? There's nothing scarier, Joanne, than the idea that the police who are supposed to protect you are criminals.
Yeah, it's very frightening and unfortunately a very deep set problem here in Mexico. There is a plan of this new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, an 8-point security plan, which he's got the backing of the three major parties for. And that does include pushing through the legal reform to try and make a kind of open system with jurors in Mexico. And also more coordination among the police and cleaning out the police and so forth. They're very hard challenges. It does take, you know, it will take a long time to do this. It's not something that can happen overnight. Basically, you've had in Mexico for hundreds of years a justice system, which is not based like in the United States or in England on juries and on kind of evidence and so forth. It's more keeping order through a system of power, really, is how it's functioned fundamentally, where you have when somebody's really upsetting the balance, they can give them. But it's basically a very difficult uphill challenge to create a decent legal system in Mexico, which will take time. And that is, again, another crucial element to trying to make some kind of peace in this country.
Well, just in closing, Joan Grillo, I mean, obviously, there's a responsibility on part of the American drug consumer to recognize the mayhem that the money that they spend on drugs is ending up causing 70,000 deaths and 20,000 disappearances in Mexico just in the last 6 years. Obviously, I think drug users probably don't have a, you know, they're sufficiently impaired not to care, I suppose. That's one way of looking at it. But I often feel that the U.S. is getting it both ways. You know, they huff and puff about how Mexico is corrupt. At the same time, they're the ones that are corrupting the place.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's long overdue to have this big debate about drug consumption. Interesting, the idea about drug consumers, drug users being conscious about, you know, where that money goes. I think it's very difficult. I think it'd be very, very difficult to persuade people not to take drugs because drug money finances criminals. I think that, you know, very difficult. I think it's probably more realistic to look at the drug policy reform in terms of how do you regulate drugs, how do you put drug money into the economy rather than just bankrolling the, you know, criminal cartels and assassins and so forth. So I think the drug policy reform movement is very interesting in the United States right now, you know, and all of that move to legalize marijuana, first of all, and then to look at other drugs and what can be done to, you know, to have real drug rehabilitation programs, you know, or other programs like methadone or so forth, which reduce people from buying the illegal drugs and allow them to function. So I think a kind of whole rethinking of drug policy needs to be done, and I hope this is the historical time that it's going to happen.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here from Mexico City, Joan Grillo.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Joan Grillo, who's covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, The Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, The Houston Chronicle, CBC, and The Sunday Telegraph, and Reuters. He's covered the drug war in Mexico and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the United States ambassador. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how Chuck Hagel can get his revenge on his Republican enemies. Nos manejan mal. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Gimme, 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 gimme todo el poder so I can come around to poder. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Gimme, 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 gimme todo el poder so I can come around to poder. Dame, 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 dame todo el poder. Dame, dame. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorism, Tyrants and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you again.
And you have an article at Foreign Policy, Hagel's Revenge, How Obama's New Pentagon Chief Can Get Back at His Republican Enemies. It looks as though if he's got, and he certainly has Republican enemies, they've threatened to filibuster his nomination. But just today, a group of 15 Republican senators called on President Obama to withdraw the nomination of Chuck Hagel to be defense secretary. At the same time, Senator Richard Shelby indicated in a local newspaper interview that he would vote for the nomination of Hagel. So the Republican Party seemed to be sending mixed messages. Let's start out with that.
Well, they are, because they're sort of hardline group that basically feels Hagel is, you know, kind of ditched the party. And, you know, this is their revenge against him, and he's become, you know, a liberal. You've got others who say, well, wait a second, you know, this is the president's choice, and unless there's some, you know, moral problem here, you know, we've got to, you know, we've got to go along with it, because someday we may be back in power, and the last thing we want is people filibustering nominees on the basis that they don't like his or her policies.
So the senators that signed this letter, of course, the main author is John Cornyn of Texas. He's the number two Senate Republican. Lindsey Graham, that's no surprise. And then, of course, you've got a lot of the Tea Party senators, particularly Ted Cruz, who distinguished himself as the new Senator Joe McCarthy in the hearings before the Armed Services Committee of the Senate, where he accused the nominee, Chuck Hagel, of getting money from North Korea and being the choice of the Iranian government. And then, of course, Marco Rubio, another Tea Partier, is on the list as well. So are these people just covering their bases at home, throwing red meat to their Tea Party followers?
Yeah, they have nothing to lose because they can say, well, we stood up to, President Obama, and let's say Hagel, we're going to probably have to cut the defense budget as part of some, budget deal. We'll have to, run away out of Afghanistan. They can say, well, we tried to stop them, but they wouldn't listen to us. Basically, this is, there's no risk. There's no downside at all for these people. And Senator Hagel didn't do that well in the confirmation hearings. And those people that paid attention to and said, well, maybe he's not the best candidate. And they can say, well, we're just trying to do what's best for the country.
So let's turn, Lawrence Korb, to your article at Foreign Policy, Hagel's Revenge, How Obama's New Pentagon Chief Can Get Back at His Republican Enemies. And I imagine that the article presumes that he will get the nomination, right? It looks that way, right? If they've got the 60 votes even to prevent the filibuster, he's all but assured next week.
Well, that's right. I mean, he got 59 last week. And we know Senator Shelby has said he would vote that 60 right there. Senator McCain said he would vote, he would vote for cloture too. So he's got at least, he's got over 60 votes. So he will be confirmed. And the Republicans can say, well, we did our best and, we tried, to do it. So I think it's pretty certain. The thing I try to point out in that article is, the way he was trashed. I mean, it's one thing to argue with, your policy toward Iran or something like that. But, to accuse someone of, could have, gotten money from North Korea and basically going to start a war with Iran. I mean, that or allow a war with Iran to start. I mean, that goes over the line.
So let's go through what you have in your article, Lawrence Korb. Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorism, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Now, just to further look into your article at Foreign Policy, Lawrence Korb, Hagel's Revenge, How Obama's New Pentagon Chief Can Get Back at His Republican Enemies. Now, this is a pretty extraordinary list that shows the power of the Secretary of Defense in terms of political patronage. He can use his influence on closing bases in all kinds of congressional districts and cutting off defense contracts. So let's go through some of the extraordinary examples here. Let's start with Secretary Gates moving the home port for the aircraft carrier from Norfolk, Virginia to Jacksonville, Florida, and withdrawing from Japan and Germany and deciding where those troops will be reallocated. That's just one example, and you've got others.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that a Secretary of Defense, if he were mean-spirited, which, as I point out in the article, Hagel is not, and he wouldn't do that, but I think it's important to keep in mind that he does, have, extraordinary power, and he can do those things. And as I try to point out, previous secretaries have done these, things, because even though you can't close a whole base, you can move forces in and out. You can determine, what gets on the list, what doesn't get on the list. And as I pointed out, Secretary Perry in the 90s, when they closed McClellan Air Force Base outside Sacramento, basically he didn't want that to happen, so he privatized it, turned it over to the private sector. So, yeah, he can have a lot of influence. Dick Cheney canceled over 100 weapons programs when he came in there. And by and large, the Congress was, you know, only able to reverse one or two of them. So that is important to keep, you know, keep in mind.
Yeah, Cheney killed the Navy-based bomber, the A-12. He scaled back the development of the C-17, which, of course, they bought a ton of them. He halted production of the B-2 bombers at 20 instead of 132. And then Gates, I mean, he stopped the production of the F-22 at 187 instead of 347, cut a Navy ship procurement down from 32 to 3 ships, and cut the procurement for the F-35, which is a complete turkey from all accounts, etc. I mean, yeah. Panetta has done the same, right?
Secretary Gates slowed production, and then Secretary Panetta has basically allowed the Navy to continue buying the FA-18 E's and F's, so they, you know, they won't have to buy the F-35s.
So you saying that Chuck Hagel's not mean-spirited, but there's a certain pleasure in revenge, isn't
right,
there?
Right, and I was trying to point out that, you know, while during the hearings he, you know, had to absorb all their hits without taking much, that, you know, that once he gets in, it's going to be different. They're going to be coming to him asking for favors.
So that would be the case with the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham?
Well, it would, yeah. I mean, you know, I think obviously he will, you know, obviously South Carolina has a lot of installations, as I pointed out there. Yeah, it's an impact. The biggest impact, though, is going to be on Texas. And certainly Cruz was, I thought, you know, really went over the line. Even McCain, you know, claimed that he had gone over the line in some of the insinuations he was making.
So, of course, we know, not to excuse Lindsey Graham's kind of jihad against Chuck Hagel and this obsession with Benghazi. He's running, of course, against a Tea Party guy, so he's trying to burnish his Tea Party credentials, isn't he? That, not that, I, again, I'm not excusing him for his unreasonable attacks on Hagel.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, and, you know, this will play well in the primary because he is up, you know, in the next election cycle, and Republicans only lose in primaries in some of the so-called, you know, red states.
But presumably, Hagel, the Secretary of Defense, could get his revenge on South Carolina, which is...
Yeah, he could, but, you know, as I say, I pointed out that Hagel I know and everything he's done shows he won't, but I do think, you know, I try to make sure people, you know, were aware of that.
And the same would be true of Texas. But I mean, both South Carolina and Texas have an awful lot of bases. I mean, South Carolina, of course, was for years and for decades the head of the House Armed Service Committee was from South Carolina.
Right, yeah, Mendel Rivers.
Exactly. More bases than any per capita than any place, I think, on the continent.
Right.
So there's certainly room to diversify, shall we say, move some bases around, some procurements around.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there is. And it's going to be particularly acute now because we know the budget's going down, so you're going to have to make some hard choices.
So just in terms, though, of how much the neocons have gone after him, and particularly Bill Kristol at the Evening Standard, my understanding is that they've even been up in, they've sent people up to Nebraska to dig through every nook and cranny trying to find some dirt on Chuck Hagel. Is there any possibility that there could be any retribution against them? I mean, it's a newspaper, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, and again, there could be in terms of, you know, who you grant interviews to and things like that. You know, if in fact you were so disposed, as I say, I don't think he was, but I do think it's important to keep that in mind because these people think, well, I can just do anything I want, you know, regardless, you know, even if I step over the line, and then you should still, you know, take good care of me and my constituents.
Well, there is, of course, a connection, I suppose, in a way, to the, a lot of the neoconservatives are sort of cheerleaders from military contractors, starting out with Richard Perle, who worked as the aide to the famous senator from Boeing, as he was referred to, Scoop Jackson, and Cliff May and Frank Gaffney. There's a whole bunch of these people who are in that neocon camp that have been going after Hagel viciously. Could you make the case that they are shills for military contractors?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that they, you know, get money from military contractors and they want to, you know, push to increase defense spending. And, you know, that every time we talk about it, they, you know, trumpet the findings of the Aerospace Industries Association that, you know, we're going to lose all kinds of jobs. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. You know, the interesting thing is I think that some of these defense contractors are going to say, wait a second here, to some of these members, don't push too hard because, you know, we could end up being hurt if we're in your state.
So you've made the point that Hagel is not a vindictive person, but on the other hand, the facts are that so many of these people that have really gone to great lengths and behaved disgracefully and used McCarthyite tactics, there is an enormous possibility here that this could backfire, particularly on some of these spokespersons who have always been champions for military spending, like the Pearls, the Cliff Mays, and the Frank Gaffneys. I'm not suggesting that they're going to be banned from the Pentagon, but you were just saying that maybe some of the people that they've been doing some shilling for may be saying, wait a minute, guys, and back off.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, these companies, you know, will take good care of themselves. And if you get in the way, you know, whatever we've been giving you before is not going to, continue to get. And, you know, the whole thing is just a sad, sorry mess. Okay, President Obama appointed a decent man, a patriot, to the job, and
a war hero
in the election, and they trying to take it out on him because take statements out of context. And I think the most interesting thing happened today when they talked about this. You know, he had been speaking to the friends of Hamas. This guy from the Daily News said he made it up.
Right. Well, but I think the point, though, is that Chuck Hagel is a war hero, isn't he?
I mean,
he served in Vietnam. And my understanding, and you used to be in charge of manpower at the Pentagon, my understanding is that the rank and file in the Pentagon, in the uniformed men and women in the U.S. Armed Forces, are very happy with his choice. He's one of them.
Oh, very definitely. You know, other secretaries have been enlisted, but they only for a short time, then moved up to become officer. He spent his whole time as an enlisted person on the front lines and was wounded twice.
So he's somebody that is going to be very welcome by the rank and file, right?
Very, yeah, very, very definitely.
And we'll see how welcome he is by the contractors and
yeah.
Whether some of them are changing their mind about who they have shilling for them. Well,
yes,
very interesting conversation. I thank you for joining us, Lawrence Korb.
Okay, good to talk to you again. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration as the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the consequences of the impending sequester cuts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog, Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And, Dean, the global stock markets fell after comments from some members of the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, suggesting that its stimulus measures may be increasing the risk of future economic and financial imbalances. Now, how do you, does that gel with the overall argument between those who feel that what the economy needs now is stimulus as opposed to austerity?
Well, I think what you're seeing happening is that there had been something approaching a consensus on the Fed that for the stimulus camp. That wasn't always true. So if you go back in 2011, there were several people that quite strongly dissented from the measures that Bernanke was taking at the time, from QE2 at that time. It seemed
that he had won people over and there was
clear support at the Fed for strong measures. And the news that we got with the release of the minutes was that the summary minutes, that there were people on the Fed who questioned that commitment. And I think that's why you saw a reaction from the markets that the Fed may not be as aggressive in providing stimulus, continuing with QE3 or whatever we're calling it at this point, as had previously been believed.
And QE means quantitative easing. It's a euphemism for what? Buying bonds, $85 billion a month, right?
That's right. So this is this departure from normal monetary policy. Ordinarily, the Fed simply targets the short-term, the overnight interest rate. And since this downturn, we've had what we've been calling quantitative easing, where it's involved purchases of large amounts of long-term bonds, both government bonds and also, to a lesser extent, mortgage-backed securities.
So is there any a danger here in terms of servicing the debt? And I don't want to give aid and comfort to the Pete Petersons, the sky is falling deficit hawks, and it's worth noting that the Simpson-Bowles people have suddenly come back again with another proposal for austerity. And as you know, the government is about to face a sequester shutdown, or a lot of money is going to be pulled out of the economy in the name of fiscal discipline. And of course, that brings again back to the argument about austerity versus stimulus. So is there anything to the idea that if you raise the interest rates, that's going to make the servicing of the debt even greater?
Well, a few things to keep in mind. First off, when we actually look at the burden, the interest burden of the debt, we're pretty much at a post-war low. It's about 1% of GDP. We were at 3% of GDP back in the early 90s. So we're way, way low. You know, so this idea, you know, we have this horrible burden. The people say that just are not looking at the data. The other point to be made about that, you'd raise the issue, okay, suppose interest rates rise. Well, to a large extent, that doesn't matter. Insofar as we're issuing 10-year bonds, 30-year bonds, that's locked in. So what happens when interest rates rise, if for something to be the case that, you know, interest rates were to go up a lot, well, then the people holding those bonds suddenly have bonds that are worth less. And in fact, what that means is the outstanding value of our debt is worth less. That's the way it would be accounted in the private sector. So in a certain sense, that's not even our problem. But, you know, the last part of that story, why would we think interest rates are about to rise? You know, the people have been saying that, have been jumping up and down, yelling and screaming, we're going to see interest rates go through the roof, the markets are going to lose confidence, bond market vigilantes. They've been saying that for 5 years now, and, you know, the rest of us, I think, are justified in getting a little tired of hearing it. You know, it's simply not true. If you could show anything to be false in this world, that's one of the things that's false.
So then why did the markets go down around the world at the same time the dollar went up?
Well, I think, as I say, I think the main reason the markets went down was the expectation there'd be less stimulus from the Fed, less boost to the economy. So in general, you know, half the time when the markets move, it's because of no reason whatsoever, and you're going to get a lot of nonsense from people telling you why the markets move. But insofar as we could find something that plausibly explains their movement, I think it's the expectation that we're going to get less growth because the Fed's not as committed to expansionary policy as people previously believed. That was the news in the new report.
But how can you separate that out from the really big news, the clear and present danger of the sequester suddenly taking enormous amount of money out of the economy if the Republicans go ahead and shoot the economy in the foot.
Well, that will hurt the economy, but just to be clear, you're asking me about a market movement. If the market moves, you can't explain the market moving based on what's been known for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So the news was that the Fed released minutes suggesting that they were less committed to their stimulus policy than had previously been believed. The sequester we've known about since January 2nd.
Yeah, but we don't know whether it's going to be resolved, though, do we?
No, but we didn't get any new information on that. That's what I'm saying. So you can't explain the market suddenly having a fairly big movement based on no new information. That doesn't make sense.
I see. So let's talk then about that, Dean Baker, because it seems to me that these successive manufactured crises are going to surely paying a toll on the American economy. And it's odd to be in a situation where you're defending military spending, but the evidence from the last quarter of last year was that just taking a little bit of military spending out of the economy caused the growth rate to dip precipitously, and taking a lot more out with the sequester and making these cuts across the board, which everybody, of course, is crying over at the moment, is going to even do more damage. So,
Well, let's just be clear. That's been really misrepresented. Any cut to spending anywhere will slow economic growth. And, you know, there's nothing magical about the military. This is, you know, that this is being repeated in the media, and it really is kind of amazing, because basically anyone who acts that way, they just writes that. I can't imagine what they are thinking. The economy doesn't distinguish between dollars that are spent on the military and dollars that are spent on food stamps or any number of other things. A dollar is a dollar. The economy doesn't care that it's blessed as military spending. So that part doesn't make any sense. The decline in GDP in the fourth quarter, by the way, associated with military spending, was actually associated with what was reported as a very, very sharp decline in military spending. Military spending declined at over 22% annual rate in the fourth quarter. Now, it did not actually decline at 22% annual rate. There's always erratic movements in military spending, so it was reported as increasing at a 13% annual rate in the third quarter. So most of this was just a reversal of an increase reported in the third quarter. It didn't actually increase at a 13% rate in the third quarter. The reason why that happened was probably they recorded some jet deliveries in the third quarter that, you know, they were coming in over, you know, at the end of September, and they happened to all be recorded as appearing in September. So, you know, so anyhow, long and short is I'm just saying we didn't get a big surge in military spending in the third quarter. We didn't get a big plunge in the fourth quarter. This was just an accounting issue. But, you know, we're looking at the sequesters around a 7 or 8% cut in military spending. That certainly has an impact on the economy. You know, as I was saying a moment ago, a dollar is a dollar. It doesn't matter whether you like what it's being spent on or not. That's going to slow economic growth. And if we go through with the sequester, which is cuts on both the military and domestic side, it's probably going to knock somewhere around 0.2 percentage point off the growth rate. And given the economy's not growing all that rapidly anyhow, that's going to be a big hit.
Again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog, Beat the Press, and his latest ebook is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. So, just in terms of the sequester and the likelihood that the economy is going to take a hit, and again, we keep having these manufactured crises, and this is the latest one, and already my understanding is, and everybody that gets a paycheck has surely noticed that they're getting less because of the last deal that was made in an extorted kind of crisis mode was the fiscal cliff deal, which ended the payroll tax holiday. So that's already affecting the economy, surely. I mean, that's real money that people have in their paychecks that is being taken out of the economy.
That's right. The end of the payroll tax cut meant that people are paying 2 percentage points more in Social Security tax. It's on wage income up to $113,000. So for most middle-income people, they're seeing 2% more of their wages disappear in taxes. And that's a big hit, and that's going to mean they're going to spend less, and that almost certainly is going to be a drag on growth. We don't have data yet that's going to reflect that, because for most people, it was just, you know, the first time they saw it was a check maybe in the middle of the month of January or at the end of the month when they got a monthly paycheck. But, you know, we probably will see that when we get more data for February. You know, that for the most part, that's not in yet, but we probably will see that. And that's likely to slow growth probably on the order of, you know, 5, 6, 7 tenths of a percentage point. And again, you know, if we had a robust recovery, if the economy is going along 4, 4.5 percentage points, you might say, okay, we could live with that. But given that we were looking at an economy grew just 1.5% in the second half of 2012, we don't have a lot of momentum going into 2013, which means we're likely to see, you know, at best, very low rates of growth and probably not even a fast enough rate of growth to keep pace with the growth of the labor market, meaning we're likely to see some increase in the unemployment rate when we should want to see it fall.
But isn't this crazy, Dean Baker? I mean, it makes absolutely no sense to me that if we haven't really recovered from the 2008 crash, and it's been a long and painful process, and here we are, you know, limping along, and then because of political zealotry and gamesmanship and ignorance, I don't know how to describe the attitude of the House Republicans, but they're about to shoot us in the foot and add to the pain, and of course, the payroll tax cut in itself is a regressive tax. So, you know, who's the champion for the middle class out there and the working American?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I'll be bipartisan in my criticisms because President Obama hasn't stepped forward and said, look, you know, we have to stop worrying about these deficits and we have to focus on getting people back to work. I mean, reality is we don't have a deficit problem. We got big deficits because the economy collapsed. And it's easy to show. You could show it 100 different ways. We had relatively modest deficits in 2006, 2007 going into this downturn. We didn't just go on a crazy spending spree or a tax-cutting orgy. The reason the deficits exploded was because the economy collapsed, and the deficits are what's supporting the economy right now. So it would be nice if we had someone out there in a position of prominence, obviously President Obama would be best, making that argument and saying that this obsession with the deficit is nonsense. We have to focus on moving the economy. But, you know, he bought into this. You're literally raising Bull Simpson. He was the one who appointed them. He appointed these two deficit hawks to head this commission on fiscal responsibility. So he really surrendered, I think, 90% of the ground in terms of having a rational debate. I certainly don't like what the Republicans are doing, but unfortunately, as I say, I don't think President Obama and the Democratic leadership have particularly set out a much better agenda.
And he also, the president, hasn't really explained to the American people that the root cause of our economic troubles is Wall Street, and that we have what happened in 2008 and subsequent to it was the most massive transfer of wealth in history, where an enormous amount of private debt became public debt. In other words, we all got stuck with the bill.
Well, he hasn't explained the story well at all, and you know, you have a lot of people running around convinced that, you know, we got into this situation because the government was overspending or, you know, we had poor people buying houses they couldn't afford. There is a little truth to that, but that's only very, very misleading. I mean, the key part of the story was that you had banks making loans that they had good reason to think couldn't be paid back. That's the real story here, and selling them, of course, in the secondary market. He really hasn't made the argument here. He's basically bought into this deficit hawk line that, as I say, there's basically no truth to, because it's easy to show. We didn't have a problem with the deficit before the economy collapsed. And, you know, he had a stimulus package back in 2009, 2010, which was a good thing, created 2 to 3 million jobs by most estimates, and I think those are certainly reasonable numbers. But the problem was we needed somewhere in the order of 10 to 12 million jobs. And his advisors, you know, people like Larry Summers and Christine Romer, both of them left the administration, that wasn't enough. They knew it wasn't enough, and they told President Obama that. But rather than him going out and saying, well, this is a good start, but we likely need more, he said, we're going to pivot to talk about deficit reduction. So So he basically gave away most of the argument, and it's very difficult for him now to talk about the economy's real problems.
And just in closing, Dean Beckett, do you have any idea why he did that? It's always been a mystery to me. One, why he let the Tea Party run away with the outrage over Wall Street and the TARP spending. And two, why that initial stimulus package was inadequate. I mean, everybody in the world, you were saying it, Paul Krugman was saying it, everybody was shouting from the rafters. And you just mentioned even people within the White House were talking about it.
Well, in terms of, you know, why he hasn't, you know, pushed a different line, I think, you know, it's clear he's very close ties to Wall Street, you know, so he certainly got in with a lot of support from Wall Street people. Here I'm thinking people like Robert Rubin, and many of the people who hold top positions in the administration have close ties to Wall Street. So in that sense, I'm not terribly surprised that he's not anxious to confront Wall Street. On the other part of the question, I think what happened there was a couple things. One, I think they really didn't understand what was going on in the downturn. I think they really did think that the economy would bounce back more quickly. And if you look back at the projections that they and others were making at the time, they had the economy bouncing back by 2010, 2011. We should be at somewhere around 5.5% unemployment today if you look at those projections. And that's even if they didn't have the stimulus. So I think their view was, to a large extent, would have been better to have a bigger stimulus. You can't get it through Congress, and that assessment may well be right. I'm no expert on that. Certainly had to struggle to get what they got. So why not just take what you can get and then go out and celebrate it rather than saying, okay, that's not big enough. We might need more. And, you know, as you said, you know, I, Paul Krugman, many others were saying you should go the latter route. And, you know, I think events have indicated that was correct. But, you know, he's staying the course, even though that course looks like a really big loser, at least from the standpoint of the American people.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.